Welcome to Norse Mythology, the unofficial guide. It's unofficial because I'm neither a credentialed academic nor a time-traveling medieval Norse pagan, but I deal with this material directly from the sources, interpreted through the lens of the experts and their opinions. If you're looking for depth and detail in a simple and accessible way, then you're in the right place. On this episode, we're going to try something a little bit different. I am joined today by Joseph S. Hopkins, who is an author, editor, and researcher based out of Olympia, Washington. He's published several peer-reviewed articles on topics like goddesses and plants in Northern Europe, many of which I've quoted on the show. And he operates mimisbrunner.info, which is a resource-focused web project that developed out of a student reading group at the Department of Germanic and Slavic Studies at the University of Georgia. He's also recently founded a small and experimental publishing company called Hildur. Did I say that right?
Yep, you sure did.
All right, well, welcome, Joseph. I appreciate having you on the show today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I am really excited to get started. I have flirted with the idea of doing interview episodes a few times in the past, but what always bothers me about them is all the random nonsensical talking that happens aside all the good stuff. So I'm thinking if you're cool with it, we will just jump straight into questions and get this thing nice and focused on awesome content.
Sounds great. Happy to be a guinea pig here.
Cool. So there are a few people who really go out of their way to try and be what I would call good stewards of Norse mythology online. And I would say the Mimisbrunner site definitely puts you in that category. One of the things I love about it is that rather than just archiving retellings of Eddic stories, you're providing a lot of ancient cultural context regarding things like motifs and symbols and providing comparisons of different source translations and all sorts of things like that. And I want to get into some of those things in a minute, but before we dive too deep, I want to cover some basic territory. And specifically, you have a few really invaluable getting started guides on Mimisbrunner, and I'm hoping we can start off with maybe a bit of advice from an expert on the best way to get started learning about Norse mythology.
Sure, absolutely. So people approach Norse mythology from a wide variety of angles nowadays. You know, Norse mythology appears in pop culture, as we're all very well aware at this point. Marvel movies, video games, you name it. Chances are here in the West, you're likely to encounter at some point in the pop culture sphere a reference to Norse myth, right? So one way people encounter these things beyond that, or dig a little deeper beyond that, is by way of retellings. And you know, some people are pretty down on retellings. I am not myself. I enjoy a good retelling. Most of them tend to be pretty bland to me, you know, after spending so much time with the source material that the retellings are based on. But there's a lot to be said for this. You know, someone who is totally new to these things, they don't need a million footnotes. They don't need a lot of technical terms to put them off. They need, you know, they're most likely interested in the stories, the narratives themselves, and then they will likely dig deeper from them. So my usual recommendation is that if you are totally new to this stuff, a good retelling is the way to start. Unfortunately, most of those retellings are very difficult for me to recommend, but Kevin Crossley Holland's The Norse Myths is probably the best of the bunch, in my opinion. That was published, I believe, first by Pantheon in the early 80s. There's a few different editions of this, but the source texts themselves, you know, are not to be sidelined by that. They're very approachable in some cases, like the Prosetta. Anthony Falk's translation of the Prosetta being the standard text for this. And it does, however, need to be said that, you know, you don't want to skip those introductions for these texts. For example, if you were to dive directly into the Prosetta, the first thing you're going to encounter is a prologue, right? And the prologue is a sort of rationalization unclear authorship, in fact, of the material that follows it, right? Where you have the Norse gods coming from a wellspring of the classical world. You know, it's the sort of learned, quote-unquote, approach to it. And without that introduction, one would totally miss that. Or just assume that it has something to do with the traditional beliefs of the North Germanic language-speaking peoples of Northern Europe, right? The Poetic Edda, of course, is the other well-known text containing a wide variety of poems, Eddic poems, they're called. Called this, of course, because they are in this collection, actually. This type of poem, very unclear as to why they were produced this way, where they come from, who the audience was, who produced them in the first place. There's another type of poem that appears in the Prose Edda quite a lot called Skaldic poetry, which is a traditional type of poetry produced by a kind of professional poet who could be male or female. And we know very little about them beyond that. You know, how they were organized, how they shared this material beyond, well, exterior to, like, for example, royal environments. It's very unclear. There's a lot of mystery around these texts. But the Poetic Edda is very tough for a lot of people to approach. I think this also gets lost. This is lost to a lot of people who spend a lot of time with the Poetic Edda, that, you know, a lot of people are just not used to sitting down and attempting to approach really dense stanzas of alliterative verse containing just absolutely full of references to myth. Mm-hmm. Quite a few of them, which are lost to us today, you know. So those two primary sources are approachable, very enjoyable, but you might be better off starting with a retelling, then going to the Prose Edda, and then from there diving into the Poetic Edda. But, you know, you can really do yourself a big favor by approaching those texts, the Poetic Edda and the Prose Edda, with handbooks. The two best-known handbooks are John Lindau's Handbook of Norse Myth. This was published, I believe, the first time in the late 90s, and it is kind of encyclopedic in style. But each of the entries is a short essay on the topic by Lindau, who uniquely has quite a strong background in folklore studies, very important for this material. And then you have Rudolf Zimek's Dictionary of Northern Mythology, which is much more expansive, but contains a lot of issues unique to it. For example, some of the entries will contradict each other, almost as if they were written by somebody else entirely sometimes.
Do you suppose they might have been, by the way?
I have no idea.
Well, I've noticed that as well.
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I don't want to second guess Zimek anything negative about it, but they really do read like they were written by two totally different people sometimes with totally different opinions. You know, I actually produced a index for this handbook because one doesn't exist, which is one of its biggest weaknesses. But, you know, it's still a crucial resource for anybody studying this material, if only because a lot of these entries cover topics that are so rarely discussed. Not only in English, but in other languages as well. You know, these are super obscure topics that are covered in this. But, you know, I've been lately recommending John Lindau's Old Norse Mythology. It's just simply called Old Norse Mythology, and it differs considerably from his earlier Norse Mythology, the handbook. Mm-hmm. It's an introduction. I believe we talked about this a little bit the other day, to the text that is kind of aimed at a quote-unquote educated general audience and goes in depth exterior to a sort of encyclopedic style, so you can just read it from beginning to end, whereas with a handbook, you know, you're probably just gonna be looking up entries or randomly picking things.
Right. My new copy of that book, Old Norse Mythology, just showed up today, so I am really excited to get into that myself and see if there's anything I can quote from it on the show here, you know. So we mentioned how Zimek's handbook is interesting, and sometimes it reads like it's written not necessarily by one person all the way through. And, you know, that may or may not be true. But if it is, it's funny. It occurs to me that that may not be all too different from something like the Prose Edda, right? We often think of it traditionally as being written by this guy named Snorri Sturluson. And I think for convenience, we often just say Snorri says this and Snorri says that. But in truth, isn't there a lot of evidence that maybe he didn't write a large part of that book?
Right. So this is an ongoing issue with scholarship surrounding the Prose Edda. And that is, we really don't know why the Prose Edda was composed beyond being some sort of handbook. The general idea is that it is a handbook for poets, right? Mm-hmm. And this is, you know, pretty obvious if you read it. You know, at least part of it is that. But at the same time, we think of authorship today as being the result of a single person. But, you know, manuscripts can be modified, and they frequently were. It is very unclear what was composed by who, and it is possible that Snorri had nothing at all to do with the Prose Edda. So then you find these papers where some scholars psychoanalyze Snorri, and I'm going to avoid trilling my R's and using these like,
Sure.
the just so you can look this up a little bit easier if you want. A lot of there should be much more suspicion about the authorship of these books. The Prose Edda is actually a collection of books, you could say. They're not quite chapters, but they're distinct sections, right? And prologue especially is very redundant if you compare it towards the end of Gylfaginning, for example. It almost seems as if it was tacked on. There's been a lot of discussion about that, as if the book itself did not have enough of a warning on it for readers. So the prologue was like, staple onto it later. The book itself, some stuff does certainly appear to have been added by later scribes to the manuscript, but I am extremely cautious about describing the Prose Edda as authored by anyone in particular, especially given that an earlier version of it may have existed as early as Saxo's time. My most recent paper discusses this. The Prose Edda contains a variety of Eddic excerpts that are not found in the Poetic Edda, right? Indicating that the Prose Edda author or authors had access to quite a lot of Eddic poetry that we do not, which informed their writing, right? To what extent it informed it, great question. But a lot of stuff that sometimes can be assumed to be invented by Snorri could well be something that existed in an earlier tradition. Maybe someone else invented it, or it could well have been in a source now lost to us. So I tend to approach the Prose Edda as being the stuff that isn't clearly rationalized could well extend from some lost source. Whether that be oral tradition or perhaps an earlier manuscript collection that was similar to the Prose Edda in some way.
Right. So an example of that might be the little bit, it's one or two stanzas that he quotes of a poem about Njörður and Skadi, for example. And so we know that that poem existed, but its entirety doesn't survive anywhere that we know of, correct?
Exactly. And that is a very important example, because that those very excerpts, they do appear to be excerpts of larger works, are quoted in a rationalized form in Saxo Grammaticus's Gesta Danorum. So we know that he had access to those stanzas. They existed at that time. They were certainly not inventions. And the funny thing is that we don't get much more information than that we can detect anyway from Saxo about that entire tale of Skadi and Njord, beyond what we see in the Prose Edda. So there's no it could it implies that whatever Saxo was drawing from may have been very similar to the Prose Edda source. We don't see, anything deviating too much from that, but at the same time, it's difficult for us to detect that because we don't have anything to compare it to, right? So, for example, Njord's sister wife. It's very hard to say if the quasi incestuous situation that this sort of stand-in figure for Njord, if that reflects like an earlier narrative or not, it's an open question.
Right, because Saxo in particularly, he draws more so even than Snorri by far on the classical tradition to sort of create this euhemeristic history. And so any given thing that he mentions, I think on this show we talked specifically about the episode with Odin and Rindr, the way Saxo presents it. And there's a lot of that that seems like it might be reflections of things that get touched on just a little bit here and there in the Poetic Edda. And then there's a lot of it also that makes you wonder, did he just steal this from some ancient Greek, thing, and just kind of mishmash it all together? It's tricky.
Right. That's what makes Saxo such a tough source to deal with. And Saxo is very transparent. to making references to the classical record, right? He makes a
Right.
lot of them, which is not something we see in, for example, Eddic material. We don't see references to Christianity. We don't see references to classical figures, transparent references anyway, right?
Right, at least not so much outside the prologue to the Prose Edda.
To be clear, sometimes you'll see some rationalization stuff like that. But for example, the Poetic Edda, where you have alliterative verse, it's just not—it's not there. So that's why there's a lot of questions around some of these. Like, was there Christian influence here? Was there not? Because there's no explicit reference. You know, same way with the classical stuff. But yeah, like you said, the prologue is pretty clear about that. And there are some references. Actually, there are some references to Christian items in the lists towards the end of one section of the Prose Edda, and some classical things too. But it's not overbearing, like we see with, for example, Saxo. But you know, Saxo's goals were very different. He was not there to, you know, create a catalog or a guide for poets or anything like that. He was writing for essentially the royal house of Denmark at the time. You
Right.
know, so it wasn't like he was cultural preservation in the sense that we would think of the Poetic Edda or the Prose Edda. It just wasn't the goal. And I think that's very important to keep in mind if anybody wants to approach Gesta Danorum.
Absolutely. It's also much bigger than the Eddas. It's
It's
a
huge.
large, large multi-volume work.
Exactly. It's enormous. And a lot of it will be of limited relevance to someone studying, you know, what we today call Norse mythology. Only the first several books are usually, there's some stuff in the later books, of course, but the earlier books are clearly drawing from some kind of Old Norse source. In my opinion, it's most likely to be a manuscript, and also probably informed to some extent by oral tradition, which was surely still quite valuable at the time for drawing information from.
Right, and that's an interesting point too, because obviously there's a good bit of controversy surrounding the dates of any given poem in the Poetic Edda, for example. But generally, I think the consensus is that these are, at least later Viking age compositions, like from the 900s a lot of times, or maybe the 1000s, right around that point in history. And it's interesting to me that we know, or we're pretty sure, that this idea of preserving myth through alliterative verse that was memorized and passed from generation to generation is much, much older than that. And so it's interesting to me that the Poetic Edda in particular, I think you mentioned that we don't know exactly why it was collected in the way that it was, but they all, for the most part, seem to be around this timeline, and we don't have much in the way of poems that are earlier than that. And it's made me wonder if maybe that's because the language had just changed so much by that period of time. We're left with the poems that make the most sense to the most people, or if there's some particular collection of authors that whoever compiled this thing just happened to like, or something like that. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, so when we think of the Poetic Edda, it's easy to kind of get an idea of some sort of canon or something like that as to what should be in this collection, right? But the reality is that the Poetic Edda is just a collection, kind of a grab bag of Eddic poems, right? That are then recompiled into a collection. Even today, there's kind of disagreement as to what should be in this collection, which you can see when you compare the various translations, what people leave out, what people put in. I mean, for example, there's the Song of the Sun, which is an explicitly Christian Eddic poem, which is very late and clearly patterned off of earlier Eddic poems, right? And there are a few collections that include this poem as well. Okay. So the question is, you know, textualization. This all revolves around the question of textualization. And what I mean by that is when this material went from oral tradition to a textual tradition, right? When someone spent great time and effort to meet with an informant and record what this informant had to say, right? And the idea seems to be generally that whether this occurred towards the end of the Viking Age, towards the end of Christianization, or if it was something. The question, I should say, is whether or not this occurred towards the end of the Viking Age. during, you know, while paganism was still, you know, pretty mainstream, and had not been like officially, you know, officially Christianized, or if it was something that was still sticking around in oral tradition for a while, you know, afterwards,
right,
and then recorded. This raises a lot of questions about textualization and who had the money and time to do this and why they would do this, because it's a huge undertaking, right? To record these Eddic poems. That's a massive mystery in the field. And the reason for the dates is that's just the end of the era, basically, for textualization. And if someone had like memorized these poems and they were being recited in some sense, some way, perhaps sung, I've seen some pretty convincing arguments that this material was sung traditionally or performed in some way.
Right.
It's a great question as to why, when, and where. But, you know, the earliest manuscripts are from the 13th century. We know the material is considerably older and has been dated generally towards the end of the Viking Age, with some exceptions. And, of course, the idea of the Poetic Edda, like I said, is going to vary on a case-by-case basis. It's probably better to just speak of Eddic poetry in general rather than the idea of the Poetic Edda as a collection.
So with regard to that type of poetry that tends to be included in a thing called the Poetic Edda, you mentioned that on the one hand, it can be tricky for somebody to just jump straight into the Poetic Edda without any other sort of background to the material, because it can be this sort of this dense alliterative verse with lots and lots and lots of references that it just sort of expects its audience to already understand.
Yeah.
But I think one of the reasons that you and I both like Caroline Larrington's translation is because she does a great job at giving us an English version of these things that, even in light of all that, is still very approachable. And she provides a small set of notes that help with interpreting some of the things that are a little bit more obscure or don't make tons of sense at face value. What sorts of things would you say somebody should look for in terms of coming across a translation of either of these Eddas? What are some signs that, hey, this is a good translation worthy of my time? What are some red flags for things that, you know, people should be wary of? I guess I'm not asking for you to throw any particular translator under the bus, if that makes sense.
Sure.
But, you know, what makes a good translation? How can we know we've found something good when we see it in a library or bookstore?
Yeah, so first of all, you're going to most likely, you know, unless it's like something special. Well, okay, so let's talk about translations specifically. Let's just talk about scholastic translations. This can go in a few different directions. What you're going to want to look for first is probably a university press. You know, that's a safe bet. If it's not on a university press, like, you know, University of X or whatever, then you should probably start with one that is. And that's because it's gone through a vetting process that other publishers are not likely to provide, right? Mm-hmm. So for example, you know, Caroline Larrington, this is a Oxford World's Classics edition, right? And her 2014 translation, her revised edition, is very different than her 1996 edition. So I'm going to be talking about that edition specifically.
Right.
Larrington provides quite a lot of notes and a lot of discussion. Now, you may not initially think that you need this, right? But trust me, you definitely do when reading Eddic poetry. You're going to be going through this and you're going to say to yourself, what on earth are they talking about?
Right. And
you're going to want to have someone explain that to you, because Eddic poetry is presented to you without its original context, right? I think it's generally agreed upon, I think universally, that this was an oral tradition, right? And right. that this material would be transmitted orally to an audience, okay? Whether that means it was performed or sang or what have you, and that audience would be aware of the many references, as you imply, in the material, okay? So you're already at a disadvantage when approaching this material. And you may have picked some things up along the way about, for example, Thor or Odin or what have you, that do not square with the historic record, right? And by approaching, or say picking up an edition with a lot of notes and a lot of supplementary material, is going to that will help you get through this, and you're going to come out a lot with a lot you're a better experience than if you did not have that edition. Because
Right.
if you encounter an older translation, maybe from the 19th century, the notes in there are going to be very dated. Archaeology was really in its infancy at the time, for example. A lot of big finds hadn't occurred yet. But if you grab a more recent translation and it has no notes at all, you may very well be at a disadvantage versus that older translation because you're not getting that explanation, you know.
Right.
Nobody is clarifying what this stanza means. And a variety of other sources can help you along the way with that. You know, you have a much better experience with a lot of notes, things like charts and so forth. So, and that's why Larrington's edition is the current standard over everything else. I don't agree with everything that's in that edition. You know, she does a lot of swapping out culturally specific terms for things like classical equivalents. Like, for example, I think she swaps out norn for fate. She at least did that for her first edition. I'm not a big fan of this kind of approach because there's not a one-to-one equivalent to those, you know, two different
Right.
concepts. And additionally, you know, people come when they think of classical myth, they will bring all sorts of, you know, things from pop culture with them to the table too. So it's just not very helpful. To me, the solution is always a footnote explaining what this or that is. But you got to strike a balance, and I think Larrington does a pretty good job of that versus some of the earlier translators. For example, Hollander's editions, especially his second edition, tends to veer towards a sort of poetry of his own, you could put it that way, which makes it very difficult to follow and not necessarily very accurate either. I think Larrington does a pretty good job of striking that balance.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. That's why that second edition you mentioned is the one that we use on this show all the time. So we've talked a lot about the core sources that we have for Norse mythology, but one of the things I think is important to keep in mind, and you handle this very well on Mimisbrunner, is that Norse mythology is not this isolated little system that existed in a vacuum and was completely unique from religious systems across the rest of the world, right? It fits within this much broader umbrella of Germanic mythology. Do you mind talking a little bit about how Norse mythology relates to Germanic mythology and religion?
Sure. Yeah. So let's go ahead and define what we mean by Germanic in this case. So at its core, from a philological, that is linguistic, the science of linguistics perspective, when we use the term Germanic, what we're talking about is a community of speakers. Okay. It's a language family. And this is the term we use for it could really be anything. We could just call them I don't know, the poodle family or something if we wanted to. It's just a classification term, right? For a group of languages that are related to one another. And they're related to one another in that they stem from a single source or a single language group. That's the better way to put it. And from that group, they all evolved, right? Now, this can be envisioned with like a tree chart. Right. That also has its weaknesses because some of these sister groups will influence each other as well, right? So
Right.
it's not just it's not just growing from a single point, it's various points of influence beyond that, right? And those language families stemming from that common ancestor, which we typically call Proto-Germanic, a reconstructed dialect continuum, most likely, from a couple thousand years ago. This language family spawned quite a few languages that still exist today. One of them being English, right?
Right.
Also, like Dutch, Afrikaans, all these sub-dialects of these languages. These are West Germanic languages, German. Also, West Germanic language. Then you have the North Germanic languages such as Danish, Norwegian, Swedish, Icelandic, Faroese. And then there is a branch known as East Germanic, which is extinct. The best known example and least controversial example of that being Gothic, which survived. It seemed quite late, actually, and around what is now Ukraine, but eventually was replaced with, I think, most likely Slavic languages in the area. So we are able to reconstruct Proto-Germanic by its descendants to varying degrees of success. And what I mean by that is, in some cases, we lack enough data to produce a reliable reconstruction, right? But this is not guesswork. It is, in fact, informed by things like observations we can make on sound changes. And it's a very well-founded field. Historical linguistics is what it's called. And these speakers of these languages, who stem from a common source, were of course influenced by their neighbors to some extent or another, particularly after they were Christianized. But they also appear to have retained specific elements of not only that pre-Christian Germanic religion, but also folklore more broadly. For example, elves, right? You can find mention of elves among the Old English. You can find mention of elves among the continental Germanic peoples. You can find mention of elves throughout the North Germanic record. Dwarfs, same thing. Certain deities, certain gods like Odin, Frigg, and most likely, in my opinion, much of what we see in Norse myth appears to have been a good indicator of what this looked like from a very early period. Now, you get people who will disagree with this, and they will stress difference rather than commonality. But looking at what we can see, I tend to see more. I tend to see more in common than I see in difference. Right? For example,
Right.
the Lombardic origin myth is extremely similar to some Eddic stuff that we have, prose material that appears in Eddic stuff, no less. So it's a huge topic, but Germanic mythology refers to a, I guess you could say, supergroup, whereas the Norse mythology, as we call it today, is a subgroup of that specific to North Germanic language speakers. I hope that was a clear explanation for what is a complicated topic.
No, I think that's great. I'll sort of give the example as well that I've used, and I would love for you to critique this example. So one of the things that I've said before to kind of explain this idea is, if you look at Christianity, which is something that most of us, at least in the Western world, if you can still use that term, are familiar with to some degree, you see that there are lots of different branches of it, right? So you can take a Catholic in Spanish-speaking South America versus a non-denominational Christian in the United States, and they will speak different languages, and so they will have slightly different names for what is essentially the same God, right? You have Jesus Christ on the one hand versus Jesucristo on the other hand. But both people would agree that when they talk about Jesus Christ or Jesucristo, even given their different branches of Christianity, they're talking about the same God. And they would understand each other as still talking about the same person, even though their own branches of this religion have some pretty significant differences, right? The veneration of saints versus not at all, for example. There are some big differences among sects of Christianity, but they can recognize that overall they're part of this same thing, worshiping essentially the same deity type of beings. Is that a relatively decent way to sort of explain what's going on, maybe with Germanic religion?
I think that's a reasonable explanation. I think the problem with the Germanic record is that we just don't have enough data
Right.
to really chart that out, as we can easily do with good chunks of the history of Christianity, right? We don't know how this stuff played out. We just get these references over vast times and huge distances from one another, right? For example, what is now Italy versus Scandinavia, you know? We get some very similar tales over a huge span of time and place. So I think it's a reasonable comparison, though.
What are some examples of things, I guess any sorts of poetry or clues or archaeology, things that just spring to mind for you that do inform? You mentioned, for example, the Lombardic origin myth. That seems very similar to some stuff in Eddic poetry. What are some other things that you can think of that help us understand similarities across this larger sphere?
Sure. So one of my favorites is the Nine Herb Charm, which is an Old English charm for some sort of malady, which is an alliterative verse, focuses on the number nine very, very strongly, which we see throughout the North Germanic record as well, and happens to feature the West Germanic, specifically Old English version of Odin. And this version of Odin appears to be in some important ways very similar to what we see in the North Germanic context. For example, he's a healer.
Right.
And he seems to be associated with some idea of magic very strongly as well. And he's also associated with plants. In some Old Norse material, we see, for example, Odin smearing plants on the head of Mimir, right?
Right.
And bringing him back to life in a sense, right? And then wisdom comes from that head and speaks to him. There we have the plants, we have healing, and we have magic, right? Three specific associations. Elsewhere in the West Germanic sphere, we have these specific charms attested in Old High German, right? There are two of them. They're pretty widely accepted as stemming from the pagan period. Remarkably so, as it's unclear as to how that happened exactly, given the history of Christianization in the area. But they are focused on, you might see them called like the horse charm or the Merseburg charm too. There's a variety of things that it's described as. But in any case, in this charm, we have a big focus on the number six. Again, a multiple three. And there are six gods referenced in this charm. One of them happens to be the Old High German version of Odin. And he is here again healing with these five other gods. A hurt horse. It appears to be like a wrenched horse's foot, right?
Right.
And again, we have the healing motif. They're all headed to a wood. There's more I could say about that. But there's a general association with healing, right? The problem is we only get like a brief glimpse into these bodies of myth exterior to the North Germanic sphere. And when we do, though, they're very similar to what we see in the North Germanic sphere. Therefore, it begs the question, was this god very different in these spheres, or was he exactly the same, or was he a little bit the same, etc.? And you know how these discussions go.
Right.
I tend to err on the side that they were very similar, if not in many ways identical, with some level of innovation in the area, because that's just what we see in the record. There's a lot more similarity than there is difference. We don't see, for example, some mention of Odin as like, I don't know, riding a dolphin or something,
Right.
that would just be like totally different than the North Germanic record. We don't see him, I don't know, blowing fire or something, just something that would be totally exterior to what we see there. Instead, it's almost always something very similar to what we see in the North Germanic record. So, your initial question was, what does the rest of the record look like, right?
Yeah, just some examples of things that show us similarities from outside of Scandinavia.
Right. So, well, the earliest reference to Germanic myth that we get that is in any way reliable is Tacitus's or Germania. And we do get some scattered references that are generally accepted to be very similar, if not directly related to the North Germanic sphere. We get a bunch of scattered things in the West Germanic sphere, and we get very little in the East Germanic sphere. In fact, we get very little, period, in the East Germanic sphere, unfortunately. So, we see quite a lot of similarity with the West Germanic stuff. I'm sure there's some level of innovation, but it's much more scattered. We get like a little charm here, we get a little reference here. We might get something in a broader work that just randomly mentions this or that. And then we get a lot of stuff in later folklore that seems to be related, but again, is pretty distant in time and place, so.
You mentioned that you tend to err on the side of thinking of these different branches of Germanic religion as probably having a lot more similarity than difference, or at least when it comes to ideas of some of the major deities. And as you were mentioning that, I had a thought about how that is partially one of the reasons that I am often very cautious about retellings as opposed to the source material. And I liked your advice from earlier on that there are some good versions of retellings that people can read that are not just absolute craziness. But part of the thing that I think is important to keep in mind when we read something like a modern retelling is that the person telling you the story is embellishing it in some degree to make it interesting or to make it into the type of story that we expect to hear with our modern ears and modern brains. And oftentimes those little innovations and embellishments that they make run the risk of being outside of what would have been an obvious expectation for ancient Germanic pagan people, right? So for example, there is this idea that's very, very common in retellings of the Binding of Fenrir, that Fenrir originally started off as this innocent, happy little wolf puppy who just wanted to be friends with everybody and never would have been a problem if the gods hadn't betrayed him and chained him up. And there's a, to me, obviously I can't prove this, but I feel very strongly that that misses a lot of the cultural context about wolves and what that story is trying to relate. Apart from the fact that the version of the story that we do have preserved in the Prosetta doesn't even say anything like that, right? But there's this idea that a retelling or any sort of interpretation that we might put on an ancient story in modern times runs the risk of being completely outside of what would have been, what would have even made sense as part of that story from an ancient perspective. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, you know, I've got a lot of thoughts about this in particular. The matter of retellings is really fascinating to me, right? So a big part of my background is folklore studies, and is really a topic of central interest to me. And retellings of narratives, let's rewind a little bit. So one thing that you can see in modern performances, we don't see this as often as we once did. You know, it's nowadays pretty uncommon for somebody to just kind of like get into a situation where somebody retells a folktale, you know, orally. But it used to be pretty common. And one thing that you can observe is that when those retellings occur orally, the narrative can be changed to fit the audience, right? Mm-hmm. What might interest the audience, what might excite the audience. Now, your point being that if our, you mentioned that, you know, some sort of deviation from the expectations of the audience would appear marked, would appear odd to them, right? Yeah, I think that's reasonable. But the way retellings, you know, work today, I don't necessarily have a problem with people innovating on the retellings as long as, you know, it's clear to them that this isn't representing the historic record.
Sure.
Because then they're just going to be confused. But people producing modern retellings are, of course, free to modify the materials they want. They're just a part of a tradition of retellings at that point, in my opinion. And I don't have any issue with that. But when there's a claim that it reflects the historic record, obviously people are going to be led, you know, astray with that. They're going to be confused. And if they go digging for it, they're not going to find that and be disappointed. The Fenrir example being a good one.
So earlier we were talking about the Merseburg charms, and you mentioned the woods, and you said there were a lot of things you could say about that, and then you gravitated away, but I'm going to pull you right back to that as we change okay, topics sure. a little bit here, because one of the things that fascinated me as I started branching outside the Eddas for myself and reading different scholarly publications and stuff like that was just how tightly intertwined just about every concept in Norse mythology is with trees in some way. And I think I did something like 3 of my earliest episodes on tree-focused topics, or at least covered them in some large degree in many of the early episodes. But what's interesting is Iceland, where most of the Eddic stories come from, was deforested pretty quickly after the arrival of Norse settlers, as I understand it. And so what that means is that we have to sort of tease out this relationship of trees, I think, a lot of times in these core sources. But what are some of the things that we can look at for evidence of this very tight coupling between religion, mythology, and trees specifically?
Yeah, so the North Germanic record just teems with references to trees as some sort of central point of focus. Probably the best example is Yggdrasil, the central sacred tree around which everything exists. You know, in the the Old Norse conception of the world, it is exceptionally tree-focused in this sense, right? But also, the origin of humanity starts with trees, right? So we see Ask and Imbla, first name being Ash, like an ash tree. The second name, pretty unclear, might mean, like, some have proposed that it means elm. Others seem to think that it has something to do with some vines. Yeah, there's pretty good reasons for both of those explanations. But the beginning of humankind and the self-conception of humankind is one of trees, as well as the center of the cosmology, rotates around the central tree. This is so much so the point to where humans can be referred to as trees in poetry, and the idea is generally that this reaches back to this idea of humankind being extensions of trees. There are many examples of the central placement of trees throughout the corpus, the Old Norse corpus. For example, the Volsungs, their entire narrative focuses on a beginning with a central tree and a hall, if we are to follow the saga representation of this tale anyway, where Odin appears and actually pierces the tree with a sword. And this tree is called Barnstalker, which is like, it's either child trunk or fire trunk, depending on if you want to modify that R with, I think it's metathesis is the process. So there's much to be said about that. This idea of people being trees and the tree being the center of everything, returning to the old High German charm, what's happening here is that the gods are going to a tree. Well, they're going to a group of trees, specifically a holt is the cognate form of holes. There's a good question as to why that is. Is this just like a narrative motif? Why are they going to the tree? In my opinion, this is very, very similar to what we hear in the Old Norse corpus, where the gods are repeatedly going to Yggdrasil to hold their court, right? And perhaps this implies their court being a thing, I should say. It's not like a, some sort of medieval idea of what court would be. This is a traditional Germanic assembly. It's called a thing. It seems to me that, this may reflect that. Although it is a charm and a charm follows a specific formula, it is still quite similar to that repeated motif that we see, for example, in Voluspa.
Right, and it's interesting too, because there are a lot of gods who have very easy associations with certain trees. Thor with oaks, for example, we see that a lot. And it occurs to me that a holt or a grove of trees, even I haven't seen any research on this, but it's just something that occurred to me, was that you might stand in a grove of trees and look around and get the sense that you are among very, very old beings meeting there in council or in a thing, right? And it makes sense to me just sort of visually and in terms of an experience that you could relate gods to these things holding council in something like a grove. And that all of that sort of thing ties very well together. And there's a different question coming after this, but if you have any comments on that, I'd love to hear them. But with that said, we know that trees are super important in the Germanic record. Do you know also if trees share a similar importance in any other Indo-European religions, Celtic, Vedic, Balto-Slavic, Greek, anything like that? Or is this something that we can say is more of a uniquely Germanic type of a thing?
I would say the origin aspect of it and the central tree in the middle of the cosmos is unique as far as we can tell. But all of these groups have a big focus on sacred groves and sacred trees, right? In fact, well beyond the Indo-European sphere, this seems to be the case. Almost universally, there is this focus on groves and trees. This Indo-European focus on groves still exists in India, for example, where sacred groves are still maintained. Unfortunately, this is less and less the case with the quote-unquote modernization of India. But these groves they perform not only a religious function, but also an environmental one. There are a lot of plants and animals outside of their range in these areas, these sacred groves. But they perform in the modern period, I should say, I'm they have a very important function. But they had a very important function back then among these groups too, that was a little bit different. It's very hard to make sense of what we would see, for example, in a Slavic mythology, because so little survives today,
Right.
right? But we do see indications of sacred groves throughout the region, and I would assume throughout much of the world too.
And that's interesting. I'm not a geographer, but we mentioned how Germanic is like an umbrella word that encompasses a few groups, one of which being Norse, and then there's this even larger umbrella over that. So Germanic being one of the groups, and Celtic being another, and Vedic being another, etc. And these, we call these Indo-European, and I know that there is some debate about this, but I think there's a large consensus that the point of origin for a lot of these groups is somewhere on the Pontic Caspian steppe, maybe southern Russia, northern where Ukraine is, kind of in that area. And like I said, I'm no geographer, but I think that's a very grassy area with not a lot of trees. And I don't know if it's always been that way, but it's curious that so many Indo-European groups would have such a focus on groves and trees if they all share an origin in a place where those types of things are not common.
Sure, I think you can still find big clumps of trees here and there though, even in pretty arid areas, depending on where you are exactly. Certainly if you are a nomadic people, you can, make regular visits to these locations, for example. And I don't know how much this has been explored from this lens. Most of my focus is in the Germanic sphere.
Sure.
But I do think it's an interesting question. How old is this exactly? How old is this focus? I'm currently working on a paper about some ancient Greek material involving the Homeric hymn to Hermes and a cluster of motifs in Voluspa involving Yggdrasil. And the Greek aspect of it, the Greek side of it, does not have any mention of trees, but it does mention bees, which can, of course, live in trees or in rocks. And it appears to me that the sort of center of the cosmos, so to speak, in that context was conceived of as a mountain, right? So it's still like a high landmark. So it's hard to make sense of that without some more comparative surveys, I think. And again, it's very unfortunate that we don't have a better idea of, for example, what the mythology of Celtic speaking peoples look like,
Right.
or what continental Germanic mythology looked like beyond the comparative material that we can, put forth. So, I do suspect that the continental Germanic peoples similarly had a central sacred tree, the same idea. And we see, of course, in Tacitus, a mention of a very important grove where it seems that the first humans were thought to have come from as well. This is a motif that seems to be quite old among Germanic speaking peoples.
So I mentioned before that there are certain very tight associations between certain trees and certain gods, and I mentioned Thor and oaks. Are there some others that spring to mind for you right off the top of your head?
Tree associations between gods. I mean, you
Well,
could
so
say that.
Idun and apples, for example, there's one,
Yeah, that's a good
right?
one. That's a good one. Odin and Yggdrasil.
Of course.
And of course, we can't say what kind of tree that is. It's described as an ash, whatever that means in the context. It's unclear if that refers to a species of tree or just another name for trees in general, because it's also described as evergreen. He seems to be particularly associated with that tree. Beyond that, there is, of course, well, Thor is saved by a rowan at some point. That's interesting.
Right.
We discussed that in the past. In the modern folklore of Scandinavia and Northern Europe in general, we see a variety of personifications, essentially, of trees, like the Danish Hildemor, right, the Elder Mother. She is essentially the tree itself. That's interesting. There is also the Ash Lady. So we see much later a particular association between specific entities that are goddess-like and trees, but they are not represented in the ancient record. Unfortunately, we don't get a whole lot of mention of specific creatures and animals beyond a small group of them in the record at all. And you know, the way we think of trees and plants in general today is very different than how someone in the past would. You know, they're not thinking of like taxonomies or how these plants are like genetically related or anything like
Right.
that. You know, they're going to be thinking about them very, very differently. So hard to say. As you know from some of the papers I've published, I have talked about etymologies that associate specific beings with trees potentially. Like for example, the goddess Ilm. Or Ilmar with the nominative R, her name may mean elm actually. But at the same time, there are several other proposals that are just as likely or just as reasonably proposed as that one. So it could either be that and something else. You know, this can be a complicated matter, or who knows? Hlin, that's another one. Her name may be associated with a specific tree type as well. It's quite unclear. I believe though, just generally speaking, that the gods are associated with trees pretty strongly. You know, whether that means like specific types of trees or just like a sacred tree in a group of sacred trees, like a sacred grove. I think there's a lot of evidence for that.
So we've talked about trees, we've talked about sources and things like that. We're getting close to time for me, at least. So I want to make sure that we can at least kind of have a cursory discussion about some of the other things. I had a lot of different symbols that I wanted to ask you about because on Mimisbrunner, you have a whole section of the website devoted to certain symbols in ancient Germanic culture and mythology. And just a second ago, you mentioned bees. There are plenty of others, and I would love for everyone listening to visit that website and just explore it because there's so much great stuff there. But give us another example. What's one of your favorite, maybe overlooked, common symbols from ancient Germanic religious culture?
I think an interesting one is actually the antler. This is something that I've written about in the symbol database that you mentioned. And the antler is an interesting one, and stags in general, right? In the Old English record, we see some particular mentions of, or the appearance, I should say, of antlers under a specific context, right? There is a hall in Beowulf that much of the story rotates around, right? It's almost as if this hall is the star of the show for a good chunk of the poem, right? This hall is called Heorot, which is cognate with modern English hart, which is kind of archaic. It's a word for a stag, right?
Right.
And the reason for this name is unclear, right? This hart hall is where the lord of the Ingfrins sits, right? This royal house, the lord of the Ingwina, okay, the Ingfrins.
Right.
This is a compound that breaks down into two parts, right? That first element, Ing, and that second element is the Friends element, okay? And this is actually a group of great age. We see mention of this group, the Friends of Ing, the Ing Friends, as early as Tacitus's Germania. That's very, very old, right? 1 CE. And later they appear in Beowulf, right? Their hall in Denmark appears in Beowulf as a location. In Sutton Hoo in Anglo-Saxon England, a famous ship burial, there is a what appears to be a kind of ornamented, I think it's considered generally a scepter, with a stag on top of it with these very impressive antlers. Okay, much later in the Old Norse record, we hear about stags again in a very similar context. For example, Valhalla, you know, the hall of the battlefield dead, the
Right.
hall of the battlefield corpses, features a stag on top of it, right? Eik Theanor, I said I was going to try not to. Let's just say there's a big stag on top. So you have, again, this important central hall associated with a stag for some reason, right? And it could have been any animal, but for some reason it is a stag. Elsewhere, we hear that the god Frey, he gives up his sword for an antler for some reason, right?
The horn of the stag.
Right. So repeatedly throughout, and Freyr is a very important god. He's associated with the royal houses of certain sections of Sweden. What is today Sweden? He is also referred to as Ing, the Ing we talked about a little earlier. So repeatedly we see this antler motif associated with this very important god, but also central halls associated with royalty. So I think the antler is a good example of the horns of the stag are a good example of a very understudied symbol. I think you'll see a slight mention of some of these occurrences in some critical editions of Beowulf. But beyond that, it hasn't been explored a whole lot. But I do think there is a really interesting early Germanic symbol going on here, or at least among the Western and North Germanic speaking peoples.
Yeah, that is fascinating stuff. So like I mentioned, I'm pretty much running up on my time limit here, and I had a lot more questions I really wanted to ask you. So I hope that you will entertain the idea of coming on the show again at some point in the future. But I want to give you at least 1 or 2 minutes here at the end to plug anything you'd like to plug before we pull the plug on this episode.
Sure. Yeah. So I've recently been working on a series of experimental translations with original art with a few friends of mine, including Rim Bowdy, whose work you'll see in the icon for this episode and whose work appears all over the mimisbrunner.info project. And that is through the experimental publishing company that I've started called Hildr. And you can visit hildr.com and take a look at what we're up to. We're producing several things throughout this year.
And that's hyldyr.com, correct?
That's right.
And then Mimisbrunner is, of course, mimisbrunner.info.
That's right.
All right. Awesome. I highly encourage everyone listening to check those out. There is such fantastic work by our guest Joseph S. Hopkins on there to be read and explored and to just really enhance your mental model of what this idea of ancient Germanic religion and culture really was. So again, Mr. Hopkins, thank you for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. And we will see you all again next time on Norse Mythology, the unofficial guide.
Thank you very much.